dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venter Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the show, in addition to the next installment of The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein, I've got a couple of other things for you as well. Last week, I invited listeners who'd like to editorialize on the material I've been presenting to submit constructive and relevant commentaries to me so I can share them with you all. So we'll begin the program this week with the remarks of listener Eric Brooks. Then, since Eisenstein has been talking about systems of money that foster cooperation and sustainability rather than the kill'em and burn'em economic system we have now, I thought I'd play you a talk I came across on the subject of fraud in the current economic meltdown. This talk is very much inside the box. It doesn't question the basic morality of the system or its workings, even in its ideal state, but rather deals with transgressions within its framework. However, I know you appreciate talks on economics that are comprehensible and lively, and this one is. Then we'll close with Charles as he takes on the general question of aligning the needs of economy and ecology. So let me begin with the comments of Eric Brooks on the topic of how elites use the population question and concepts like personal responsibility as a cover for other objectives. Eric writes, "I need to raise a strong caution about your comments relating to population. There's a critical perspective on this issue that you seem to be missing. I'm speaking of the vital understanding that while population is indeed a crucial problem, corporate elites currently and wealthy elites all throughout history have purposely funded and promoted the concept of population as a source of global crises, specifically to deflect public attention away from much more fundamental and direct corporate and capitalist causes of all world crises, including unsustainable population growth. Elites, especially over the past century, have fixed this as a keystone in their very clever and powerful deflection of all criticism away from themselves and onto what is called personal responsibility. This is a jujitsu that is incredibly effective at getting the general public to always focus on their own behavior, obsessing about strategies like recycling, driving hybrids, changing light bulbs, turning down the thermostat, etc., and most crucially, supposedly failing to control their own personal reproductivity, and even more ominously, the reproductivity of the poor in the colonized global South. This purposely funded personal responsibility ploy accomplishes two very powerful things. One, it gets individuals to focus on and most importantly, fixatedly blame themselves and other middle and lower class individuals for the world's problems, while paying almost no attention whatsoever to the far more damaging corporate and elite behaviors, which are the actual cause of those problems, and two, all of these individuals struggling so desperately to make all of these personal changes, then look around at the global collapse, see that their own personal sacrifices are clearly not solving the problem in any substantial way whatsoever, And these struggling, already overworked and exhausted individuals then both give up on changing the world, deciding that it's impossible, and then go on to feel incredibly guilty that they have failed and given up. This heavy guilt, on top of their exhaustion and lack of personal time due to overwork, then translates directly into a feeling of deep political impotence, and the individual then abandons as useless even the simplest participations in democracy, such as voting and protesting. Again, it is absolutely crucial to understand that the corporate power structure is purposely funding and promoting these personal responsibility brainwashing messages. To see a powerful example of this fact, read the following article on Chevron and other corporate funding of Paul and Ann Ehrlich, originators and strong promoters of the modern population bomb thesis. The latter, who has gotten herself entrenched as a powerful leader of the Sierra Club and constantly pushes controlling population and worse, stopping, quote, illegal immigration across borders as a key to solving environmental crises. The way to solve the population crisis is to educate and empower women, and to bring oppressed populations out of capitalist-induced poverty. Solve those problems, and the population will stabilize and then start shrinking on its own. This because once women and the economically oppressed are truly empowered, they will have the capacity and freedom to exercise real personal responsibility, not personal restriction imposed by a patronizing and deceptive corporate state. And that, the commentary of listener Eric Brooks. And I invite your cogent commentaries. You can email them to me if you'd like to have me read them on air at unwelcome@radioforall.net. Or if you have the ability to make your own recording of you delivering your commentary in your own voice, please send me an MP3 instead. Swirling around the current financial crisis are discussions about the relationship of the banking industry to government, the Federal Reserve, fiat money versus the gold standard, inflation, deflation, and so on. There are a number of people, and no doubt some listeners, who think that abolishing the Federal Reserve would somehow democratize money. I hope that you are getting from what Charles Eisenstein has been saying that the problem is interest and profit that demand constant growth, and that these are inbuilt to capitalism, no matter whether there is a hard currency or a fiat currency. Put another way, it's the use of money as a store of value that is the problem with money in terms of both society and ecology, as it promotes waste and deprivation. During the period of the robber barons, the U.S. was on a gold standard, and this did not prevent an essentially feudal lifestyle for most of the population. And there has always been some sort of financial crisis, recession, depression, etc. in the U.S., on the average of once a decade throughout the country's history. Some of these events are worse than others, some are long and some are short, but they're built into a system that is predatory and wasteful and positively invites criminality, which is just a small step from the cruelty and stupidity that is legal business practice. My opinion, but I think the facts support it. Our speaker is William K. Black, the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s, which some of you may be too young to remember. But it was another orgy of bankster looting, and the comparison to the present day is interesting. Black now teaches economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and is the author of the book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He'll speak, then do a Q&A with KPFK radio host Ian Masters, and then take questions from the audience. This forum took place in Los Angeles in June.
Thank you, Hammer Forum, for arranging this. Thank you, who made all of this possible, for coming. In addition to my other sins, I'm primarily a white-collar criminologist, and I focus on what happens when the CEO is the crook. Okay, So I'm going to address two primary and related questions. Why do we have repeated, intensifying economic crises? And what can white-collar criminology add to our understanding of what's going wrong and how to fix it so we can adopt better policies that can produce fewer crises in the future? And I'd like to start with a slide.
On the screen is an excerpt of a memo issued at the Standard & Poor's Rating Agency in 2001. The text reads, "Any request for loan-level tapes is totally unreasonable. Most investors don't have it and can't provide it. We must produce a credit estimate. It is your responsibility to provide those credit estimates and your responsibility to devise some method for doing so."
Okay, so this punctuation is in the original. I didn't make it up, the all caps and the triple exclamation point. Here's the context. The professional rating type guy at Standard & Poor's has been assigned to evaluate one of these complex financial derivatives that you've been reading about that cause the biggest losses. And it's a derivative that is backed by subprime home loans. And so he has asked for what's called here the loan tapes. That simply means the loan files that we put on computer tape, so that he can review a sample of the loan files to evaluate their credit risk, because that's what a credit rating agency does, right? So it's a pretty standard request, you might think. This is the response he gets from his boss, and this is a high-level boss at Standard & Poor's, that it is totally unreasonable to ask for the files so that you could evaluate the credit risk if you're going to give a credit risk rating, right? This is significantly insane at this level, right? But why is it totally unreasonable? Well, the stated reason is that the investors, that means the investment banks that are buying these subprime mortgages, pooling them together and creating these derivatives, don't even have the loan information themselves. In other words, they did zero due diligence before they bought this toxic waste. They're now bringing it to the rating agency, which is going to do how much due diligence?
Zero.
Because the boss is furious that the professional guy actually wants to look. Now, what rating do you think they're going to end up giving? Triple A. What is a triple A rating supposed to mean? Zero credit risk, right? On stuff that has not just a little bit of credit risk, but immense credit risk. Now, how is the guy supposed to find a way to say that something that has immense credit risk has zero credit risk? What's his boss directing him to do? That's right. Make it up. That's why we pay you, right? It is your job to devise some method in which this produces a AAA without ever looking. Thank you. That completes, I will not subject you to a PowerPoint presentation. That completes the slide portion of tonight's. All right? This is a $1 trillion plus industry run on don't ask, don't tell. And you know what happened when they finally looked at some actual loan files? Fitch, the smallest of the three rating agencies, does that in November 2007. Pretty significant date because the entire market, secondary market in non-prime, has collapsed. And so they're not going to cost themselves any business at this point if they look. And Fitch says, after this small sample look at the loan files, the results were disconcerting in that there was the appearance of fraud in nearly every file we reviewed. No Sherlock, right? What do you think is going to happen if you don't look? What are they going to load it up with as long as they can get a AAA rating? Now, we know, therefore, that the people that purchased it did no credit checks that had any meaning. We know that the rating agencies gave them triple A's without doing anything. Could the buyers of these exotic financial derivatives have done any due diligence? The loan files didn't even exist for them to look at. So all those banks out there that bought well over $1 trillion of this stuff, how do you think we did stress tests? Remember the stress tests? It's like doing a stress test on an airplane wing, except you don't actually have the airplane wing. And you don't actually know what the airplane wing is made out of. But you hypothetically test it. You know, it's a farce. Okay, what can white, back to how we got here, into this insane world where people would treat as having zero credit risk things that have massive credit risk that were sure, as soon as the music stopped, to cause trillions of dollars of losses, right? How do we get there? Two concepts from criminology I'd like to do. One is the concept of control fraud, and that simply means what happens when the people that control a seemingly legitimate organization use it as a weapon to defraud. So in the corporate context, that's going to typically mean the CEO. And the concept of a criminogenic environment. If any of you are from health backgrounds, we stole this from pathological environments, right? And it simply looks at what kind of environments are going to create incentive structures where you're going to have a lot of crime. And we actually use the word epidemic to describe when you have a great deal of this kind of crime. So, how many people recall the subprime crisis of 1991-1992? It's a trick question. It's a prof you're listening to. There was none, and there was none because we killed it as regulators. People were doing the same type of insane thing as lenders. We said, this is going to end in disaster, and we stopped it. And there was, in fact, no economic crisis at all. Indeed, there was essentially no cost to the taxpayers at all. I'm going to be emphasizing one variant of this kind of control fraud, and that is accounting, right? Which is the weapon of choice in the financial sphere. But I want to also, while I have you, do the 45-second version of these kind of control frauds, different variants, also maim and kill people. And if you want good examples recently, it would be infant formula in China, where you gain a competitive advantage by not putting milk in infant formula. You end up, because of that, driving the honest providers of infant formula out of the marketplace because they can't compete with people that actually use milk when you use water and talc. Okay? So we're going to be talking mostly about money, which is bad enough. In the savings and loan debacle, the National Commission that did come along and looked at the causes said that at the typical large failure, fraud was invariably present. The FBI began testifying publicly in September 2004, emphasis on that date, that there was a quote-unquote epidemic of mortgage fraud developing in the United States. So when people tell you that nobody could have foresaw that there was going to be a problem, garbage. And they not only foresaw it, they warned people about it explicitly. Let's look at how you optimize these kinds of accounting fraud. And it's basically going to be three things. You're going to, and their first two are heavily related. You're going to grow like crazy, Ponzi scheme levels of growth. You're going to loan to people who are uncreditworthy because they will agree to pay you more, but also because that's the way to grow really rapidly. In the United States, there aren't a whole lot of people making $300,000 a year who weren't able to get a home loan. So you can't simply decide to grow very rapidly by making good loans, but you can guarantee immense growth if you loan to people who can't pay you back, right? The third thing is extreme leverage. This combination produces guaranteed, I want to emphasize that, guaranteed record, not high, but off the chart profits as long as you are in the expansion phase of a financial bubble. And therefore, if any of you come from economics backgrounds, standard econometric techniques, which is simply statistics in the economics context, produce the worst possible results and the worst possible policies during the expansion phase of the bubble. Because if you look, doing things like loaning to people who can't pay you back, hey, that's associated with the highest possible profits if you run statistical analyses while the bubble is still expanding. And collectively, all of this produces, this optimization, extraordinary losses. Control frauds cause greater losses than all other forms of property crime combined. Individual losses are massive. Ian mentioned IndyMac. IndyMac sold over $200 billion of liar's loans to other institutions, getting AAA and AA ratings for the reasons we've just went through. And those institutions are going to suffer roughly 80% losses on that portfolio that they purchased. In 1 year alone, 2006, IndyMac sold $80 billion of liar's loans. Now, think of that if you had been a regulator and the seventh largest savings and loan in America comes up to you and says, "Hi, I've got a new strategic plan. I'm going to make liar's loans." Might that have been a clue, right, that maybe this was not going to end very well? Because that's the second thing that's guaranteed, you see. Guaranteed record initial accounting profits and guaranteed catastrophic failure. So individual failures are massive. Second thing, though, is what happens when a number of folks, because of optimization, follow the same strategy? You're going to get a financial bubble, and you're going to get one that extends and hyperinflates. By the end, 40% of all mortgage loans in America were non-prime, and that's a massive market. So that's just off the charts insane. And when bubbles hyperinflate and extend, you get economic catastrophe following them. Third, at law, the element that distinguishes fraud from other forms of theft is deceit. Fraud is all about me creating trust in you, the victim, and then betraying that trust. As a result, there is no more effective acid against destroying trust than wide-scale fraud, especially by elites, and you don't get more elite than CEOs, right? When you lose trust in economic markets, entire markets shut down. I'll give you an example. Everybody's been at a picnic or a conference where there were bottles of water given out. What if you knew that one bottle in 100 was contaminated? How many of us would be drinking those bottles? Long before fraud becomes endemic, it can shut down entire markets. Regulators have not shut down these financial markets. Bankers have. And they have because they no longer trust other bankers. It's because they know what games they're playing, and they're afraid that their peers are doing just the same. The average chief financial officer in America lasts 3 years. Do you see why they're short-term in their perspective? Now add executive compensation to that with massive bonuses if you hit the number. And the number is set quite high in terms of short-term accounting profits. How long am I going to last as a CFO if I don't do these subprime loans and my rivals do during the expansion phase of the bubble? One quarter, right? One reporting result. My CEO doesn't get his big bonus. Gone. We call this a Gresham's dynamic, in which bad ethics drives good ethics out of the marketplace. And that's how perverse things became. Think how many layers have to fail to have these kinds of epidemics that we've been discussing. First, all that corporate governance stuff that you read about, that has to fail. Well, that's pretty easy because the tone at the top, when the crook is at the top, is a fraud-friendly tone, something never discussed in corporate governance literature. Then there are external controls, right? That's the outside audit firm, the appraisers, right? That working very well for us? Is that new? Did that work well in Enron or WorldCom? No. They all had clean opinions. All of the savings and loan frauds had clean opinions, and they always came from top-tier audit firms. How about the rating agencies? That working real well from what we saw? No. These entities, you don't destroy external controls. You suborn them, and you turn them into your most valuable allies. How about anybody hear the concept private market discipline? This is the essence of modern finance theory. And the economist that believed in it said that it was so wonderful, and I'm now essentially quoting, that a rule against fraud was not necessary or even particularly important. So we didn't even need rules. We didn't need the SEC. We didn't need laws. We didn't need prosecution. Markets simply stopped all frauds. But when there's a Gresham's dynamic, whether it's in China with infant formula or the United States with executive compensation, private market discipline becomes perverse, and it drives good practices out of the market. And so it isn't discipline, it's an incendiary. It's like an accelerant, if you think in arson terms, the gasoline you pour on the fire. And then, of course, there's regulation. Regulation also had to fail, and it can fail in any of four ways. There can be no regulation. There was essentially no regulation of most of the non-prime lenders. There can be deregulation. There can be desupervision. The rules stay in place, but you appoint leaders who don't believe in enforcing them. And so the classic one was the people who were supposed to be regulating IndyMac, where the chairman of the regulatory agency came to the press conference with a chainsaw posed next to the three leading banking lobbyists with pruning shears, all posed over federal regulations to indicate their intention to cut through all federal regulation. Well, they succeeded in that mission. And you've seen the result. And, of course, you can get capture as well, in which the regulators do the bidding of the industry, which I would say is largely what we have now. How sick does this end up? It ends up in producing these kinds of recurrent economic crises. And if any of you have been subjected to economics and remember it, if you were ever told about Pareto optimality, which simply means that when the genius of a market is involuntary transactions, normally both parties are made better off, right? I give up the $20 and I get that really good tikka masala and I feel better off. The restaurant is better off as well. They'd rather have my $20 than the tikka masala, right? That becomes perverse when you have these kind of control frauds. So in the typical non-prime loan from 2005 on, both parties to the transaction were made worse off. The borrower was made worse off. Indeed, there's been no greater destruction of working class wealth in American history than this crisis. 80% of the losses, according to the FBI, from mortgage fraud come when lender personnel are involved. In other words, control frauds, again. But the banks aren't made better off. That's why they're failing. So the party to the transaction, the bank, is made worse off simultaneously. Who gains? The agents, we call them, the CEOs, the loan officers that get bonuses for making bad loans, the accountants, the appraisers, those rating agencies. By the way, their profits skyrocketed by giving AAAs to stuff that was disastrous. And with that in mind, I will stop so that we have more time for you to ask questions. Thank you very much.
This is Bill's book here, and he was just showing me a telegram from Keating of the Keating Five Savings and Loan that said, if we can't get Congress to stop Black, then kill him dead. That's about as flagrant a threat that you get. It's actually a threat in writing. And I said to Bill, well, I said, surely Keating should have gone to jail for that. And he said, oh, no. His excuse was he was a lawyer writing to his lawyer, therefore it was privileged communication. Anything you want to add to that little anecdote?
Well, he did say it was his highest priority to get Black, kill him dead. I think it's the nicest compliment you can get as a regulator.
So, given that you went through that experience and you actually put people in jail, and for some reason or other, you make this case where you use the word fraud, all that's the sort of glue in your statement, really. And I don't see anybody even being indicted, let alone going to jail. So how come we have this massive fraud but no accountability?
Well, you don't have regulators right now that are quite the same, I think, as you had in our era. In addition to that, get Black, kill him dead, Keating sued me in my individual capacity for $400 million. It gets hard to get a home loan when they say, what are your contingent liabilities? And you say, there's not enough space on the form to list them. He hired private detectives twice to investigate me, that we know of. They removed our agency in Washington, removed our jurisdiction over Lincoln Savings because we recommended be placed in receivership.
That was done through the Congress, right?
That was in response to the pressure by the Keating Five, the five U.S. senators. We refused to give in to that pressure, but our eventual bosses in Washington gave in. I really need to mention Ed Gray, who was the head of the agency during this period of re-regulation, who came from Southern California, staunchest conceivable Reagan Republican, and had a Road to Damascus experience. They, the Justice Department under President Reagan, threatened to indict him for closing too many insolvent savings and loans. Have we had that problem recently with our regulators? Overly aggressive at closing insolvent banks or savings and loans? No. Gray also, and you know, at the top, and we in the trenches, put together a real program of going and supporting criminal prosecutions. And it led to the felony convictions of over 1,000 senior insiders. There are only 3,000 savings and loans. So that was about the greatest success ever. And we went after places like Lincoln while they were still reporting record profits. We didn't wait till they were admitting that they were deeply insolvent many years later. Have you seen that happening recently? No. The Justice Department didn't even begin to investigate the large lenders, non-prime lenders, until spring of 2007, after the entire secondary market in non-prime had already collapsed. And there have been zero indictments since then.
So there's no regulators. What about the FBI, and what about the law? Is the law still extant? I mean, is there something that they've crossed a line? Massively, trillions of dollars have gone south. The taxpayers had to ladle all this money into this black hole.
Well, to give you an example, I'm a serial whistleblower. So I got to testify against the Keating Five, testify against Speaker Wright. There are probably folks in the audience who remember him. He went to bat for the worst frauds in Texas. Got two presidential appointees of my agency to resign in disgrace. And got our head of supervision through our congressional testimony demoted about seven levels. Well, 17 years later, he was promoted by the current Office of Thrift Supervision to be the prime regulator for all of California for IndyMac, Washington Mutual, Downey, Countrywide, you name it. So they put in charge the worst conceivable folks. They took all the lessons we had learned painfully in the savings and loan debacle and put a negative sign in front of it and did the opposite. The FBI started out really well with this warning in September 2004 that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud. What happened is that in response to the 9/11 attacks, and you can understand why they would do this, they transferred 500 FBI agents who specialized in white-collar crime to national security because you can't infiltrate al-Qaeda, but you can follow the money. Okay, so that's perfectly sensible. But they refused to allow the FBI to replace the lost agents. And that's insane.
And has anything changed?
It got worse. As people here recall, I imagine, that there were these things called Enron and WorldCom. You may recall that Enron happened almost exactly the same time as 9/11, and that WorldCom is 2002, and those whole series of failures go on through 2003 with lots and lots of these major frauds. Well, there's a lag, obviously, in it takes time to make a big case against Enron. There were 100 FBI agents working on Enron alone. So when are they actually going to trial on these cases? Well, 2005, 2006. So you've already lost 500 FBI agents. What are you going to do? You're going to take the great bulk of your FBI agents and try to win the Enron case, right? And WorldCom. So you're going to assign most of your FBI talent there. And which of us, you know, we're going to prosecute the enormous case against Ken Lay of Enron. Are we going to pick the best FBI agents? Of course we are. So it's not polite, but you know that it was the second and third string left, right, for to deal with the mortgage fraud. And there were trivial numbers of them left anyway. So they didn't go after the choke points. We understood we didn't have remotely enough resources in the savings loan crisis either, of course, but we understood that we had to go for the Achilles heel. So we triaged, to borrow another medical term, and we took the absolute worst major frauds. And we also passed a rule restricting growth because we knew these were Ponzi schemes. And if you restrict growth, Ponzi schemes die. So even the ones we couldn't get to and close, they were killed by it. The equivalent here, well, you just saw it in the slide. What's the obvious choke point, the obvious Achilles heel? The rating agencies, there are only three of them, would give me 20 good examiners. And I could have shut down any of those rating agencies because they were doing this. And that'd be the first question you'd ask. Okay, so what do you do to evaluate credit risk? Now, obviously, you look at a sample of the loan files. Long silence. Well, no, actually, we don't do that. Well, then, actually, you're going to stop business today. I mean, that would have been the reaction. So they didn't do that. Instead, they viewed it as a retail-type crime instead of wholesale. There are 62,000 criminal referrals last fiscal year for mortgage fraud, and there were roughly 150 FBI agents. What's going to happen, right? It's throwing sand into the ocean in those circumstances, unless you use them to target WAMU countrywide and such, and they didn't do that. And you know what the worst news is? Only regulated institutions file criminal referrals, and 80% of the loans were made by non-regulated institutions. So the 62,000 number doesn't come close to talking about the real numbers. So the FBI was simply run over. It, you know, became roadkill.
Well, a lot of inquiring minds want to know why it is that Obama is rescuing these people who have brought the global economy to the brink of collapse, and why the sleight of hand continues with Geithner and Summers declaring them all healthy, and then the banks, of course, make a big deal about paying back their TARP money. And it is such flagrant sleight of hand because these toxic assets are still there. They just don't talk about them.
Well, then they don't exist, right?
Well, I thought there was something inexorable about
it. Haven't you ever had a five-month-old and hidden something under a blanket? It doesn't work once they hit about 8 months, unfortunately.
Right. But let's try and figure out what is going on with Obama. Why do, at this moment, when you could clean house, all this money is going to prop up these discredited institutions, which actually is making them stronger, and they're going to suck more and more money out. There's not going to be any money to reinvent the economy, all this stuff about green shoots and losing our dependence and Silicon Valley and all of the hope that was there in the election hype, that's not going to happen.
Because Obama's primary economic advice comes from people who helped create the crisis. And as long as you get your advice from people that don't want to admit that they were wrong about essentially everything they did in their professional lives and that they have no useful skills, because all they know is stuff that was proved to be false? I mean, you're just not going to get professors of economics who are 60 years old to stand up and say, I'm sorry, everything I taught, every policy I implemented was completely wrong. The economic theories I followed were completely wrong. And I have no useful knowledge, and I'm sorry. You know, that's not going to happen. And if they did, why would anyone ever hire them again for anything, right? They have no meaningful skills. That's the position of Summers.
Yeah, but Obama's whole political lifeline is whether he can turn this thing around in a couple of years' time. Otherwise, you can see that the people like Dick Cheney and you've got Limbaugh wanting him to fail, they're waiting in the wings to see this whole thing crash and burn. So he's on the tightrope. So why is he listening to these people if there's an alternative? And indeed, tell us what the alternative is, because
nobody talks
about that.
First, he doesn't talk to others very much, right? So there are a number of us who were involved in the successful re-regulation of an industry that was in desperate trouble, that was involved in the successful prosecution of large number of frauds, et cetera, et cetera. None of us has ever been talked to by the administration, as far as I can tell. Zero. Instead, they've gone to people who have an entire track record of failure their entire lives, right? So Geithner started out as a screwing up the Asian financial crisis that people may remember, Thailand, the collapse of Thailand and such. That was his beginning. He performed poorly there. So they made him president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, where he was supposed to regulate the largest bank holding companies in America. And he did absolutely nothing to prevent the current crisis. He was asked about this in front of Congress, and he said, well, you know, I've never been a financial regulator. Well, maybe, but his job title, you know, his job was to regulate. I'm quite willing to believe that he never regulated. So he's a complete failure there. What would he do next? He was brought in by the Bush administration with then Treasury Secretary Paulson to be in charge of the bailout type stuff, where everybody agrees that he completely screwed up, right? Nobody says anything nice about the bailout except recipients of bailout cash. There are a number of those. But everybody else agrees that they screwed up.
They all come from Goldman Sachs.
Instead of three strikes, you're out, he was made Treasury Secretary of the United States of America. And I haven't mentioned, you know, that he was a tax cheat. And he's in charge of the IRS now.
So that's almost like Greenspan's resume, too. I mean, he was the guy that tried to undercut you in the savings and loan.
Keating used Alan Greenspan to recruit the Keating Five, the five U.S. senators. And then Greenspan famously or infamously put in writing to us that we should allow Lincoln to do this stuff that eventually caused these incredible losses. It was the most expensive failure in the entire savings and loan crisis at $3.4 billion, which used to sound like a lot of money, but I know it doesn't anymore. And Greenspan said, Lincoln Savings posed, quote, no foreseeable risk of loss to the federal, deposit fund. So that was before he was made chairman of the Federal Reserve. After he got it as wrong as you can possibly get it, praised the worst savings and loan America, said it should be the model for the entire industry, we made him chairman.
Well, this is surreal, though. Why do we have the best?
No, it's real, but it's surrealistic.
But I'm just wondering, if we have the best economy in the world, or we had the best economy in the world.
Yeah, past tense.
Why do we have all this enterprise in this country, and that the chumps at the top every 10 years blow it? I mean, if you're saying that somehow we have this bizarre Peter principle where these guys fail upward.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's very useful to have people who are willing to tell you what you want to hear. Right? I mean, Wolfowitz was a complete disaster, and so what did we do with him? We made him head of the World Bank, where he was, surprise, a complete disaster, and got fired. But he's still treated as a highly respectable person, and they might even bring him back in some future administration. It's a very weird place, and indeed, Greenspan's biggest thing was hilarious, because he always claimed reputation trumped everything. right? So conflicts of interest didn't matter because people would be concerned about their reputation and they'd do the right thing. But he was a leading example of where reputation didn't matter, right? He had a bad reputation. He had a failed reputation, and we gave him the most prestigious position in many ways in the free world, right? Presidents don't have to be prestigious. They just have to be popular and get elected. But you have to allegedly be super great stuff to be made chairman of the Federal Reserve in the United States of America. It's the most powerful economic position in the entire world. And we pick people who are often have a record of failure.
So what about Bernanke then? I mean, don't tell me he's as bad as the other guys.
Bernanke's interesting. He's certainly not as bad as Greenspan, but if you, I don't know how many people were able to watch any of the testimony or read the testimony today. Bernanke was willing to threaten to use federal power in a completely illegitimate way. You know, you do what we say or we'll fire you. One of the key things, you know, I've been emphasizing a different part of the spectrum of what you need to be a successful regulator, which is a backbone, right, and some analytical abilities.
And some political support, right?
Well, we didn't have any political support, but we didn't give a damn about politics, so that was what was critical there. But the other thing you need as a regulator is self-restraint. You have to not abuse your power, because if you do, you discredit everything. And they haven't learned that part, clearly. And now they've been caught in it. Remember, the Fed is the most opaque institution in America in many ways, and they like it that way. And now you start seeing what happens when you get congressional investigations. And it, I don't think it's partisan to say that Congress really failed during the Bush administration in terms of oversight. Right. It just didn't function
that
way.
That is not a newsflash, no.
And so, you know, if they actually start doing things, you mentioned PCORA. I don't know whether people understood that reference in many cases. PCORA was the investigator that we used in the Great Depression to find out how many of these really powerful people had engaged in fraud and abuses. One of the things we discovered, for example, was that Herbert Hoover was able to buy stock at half price. Okay? If those kinds of obvious abuses, you know, to put a non-polite name on it, bribery, were the norm in this era. In this, now we have Friends of Mozilla that people may well have read. You know, both sides of the aisle, Friends of Mozilla. PCORA, it's important to realize, was the fourth person. The first three failed. They weren't vigorous investigators. And a little ode. One of the reasons PCORA succeeded, he was an experienced prosecutor, is that he hired as his number two guy a reporter who knew where many of the bodies were buried and how to ask questions more informally to get information. And the combination proved to be very effective. And it didn't simply disclose the problems, it led substantively to fixes that worked for about 50 years until we decided we were smarter than those folks and we repealed.
The Glass-Steagall Act.
Glass-Steagall, for example. Right. Because we knew better.
Well, we need to get to Q&A because I know everybody's got questions here. But let's just...
what do? You want to ask me? You wanted to ask me what to do.
Yeah, in other words, if you think Obama is listening to these discredited guys who are part of the problem, not a part of the solution, what is the solution?
Well, we write and we take opportunities like this to try to present alternative views. We want President Obama to succeed as opposed to wanting him to fail. We very much fear that this will destroy his presidency and his reputation.
But he must know that.
I don't know. No, you have to understand how seductive a cover-up is. Because you have all these people coming to you and saying, hey, if we actually deal with the crisis, it's going to cost $2 trillion. You'll have to go in front of Congress, and you'll have to use $2 trillion, and it'll be portrayed as a bailout of rich people. And you will – how attractive is that going to be politically, folks? Not very, huh? Whereas you have other people saying, shh, just keep quiet. Say that the banks are fine, right? Wait. Give them all kinds of secret subsidies, which is what we're doing, right? Keep it opaque. Keep it off the balance sheet. Keep it so that you don't need Congress to give you authority. Do it through the Fed. That's why we're doing so many things through the Fed, because Congress has so little authority over the Fed. And that's really attractive, right? The first one is painful, politically unpopular, and gets your administration off to a really bad start. The other one, hey, most of the financial press is calling them success stories. They're all emphasizing green shoots. They take hook, line, sinker, rod, reel, boat that you rode out in, these claims that there really actually was no problem, that the banks are all the big banks are healthy. Did you know that? Why is there a financial crisis if they're all healthy? Why did Geithner tell us it was going to cost $2 trillion to fix it? It doesn't square, right? But people don't remember that. Anyway, what to do to fix it? We're trying, as I say, to give alternative views. You give people their best service when you tell them the truth, not when you tell them what they want to hear. You need to fix executive compensation so that it no longer creates perverse incentives. That's fairly straightforward, right? Because we do everything wrong in executive compensation now compared to what all the books say you should do. Again, if you put a negative sign in front of that, that's what we do. We base it on short-term accounting gains in terms instead of real long-term performance. So change that. It's the most important single thing. Do a real PCORA investigation. Give the FBI at least 500, actually needs far more than that, needs 2,000 new FBI agents to do the case. The Justice Department needs more prosecutors as well. Hey, we got lots of lawyers in America. That's not a problem, as long as you give them the budget to do it. Prioritize, triage, go after the big players first before the statute of limitations runs. Deal with the regulatory black holes. Californians should know those. This is what produced the California energy crisis, folks.
Enron generated that one.
Enron generated that one and exploited that as part of the cartel. That was front to back, no ifs, ands, or buts, fraud and cartel. So get rid of those black holes on financial derivatives. In general, there's no reason for over-the-counter derivatives, and they're an invitation to disaster as opposed to exchange-traded derivatives and such. So those would be the five or six things that you could do promptly that would not only deal with this crisis but dramatically reduce the risk of future crises. And, of course, I'm sorry, I have to mention something else. Given our discussion, you got to appoint the right kind of folks as regulators, not the Geithners and Summers of the world who, again, they never believed in regulation. They were rampant deregulators and proud of it.
Well, I wanted to talk about as bad as it is, and you've given us a plan here. I don't know how to implement it and who's going to champion it and who's even going to talk about it. But that aside, I understand that there are some more shoes to drop in terms of the global economy that may mirror what we've just gone through, and that the most vulnerable part of the global economy is Eastern Europe and the Baltic states, and they borrowed heavily in euros and they're in the non-eurozone. They have absolutely no ability to pay back these loans. The stress on the West European banks will be such that it will drag us back into it.
Yes, we are overall, and by the we I mean most of the Western world, following pretty much the Japanese plan for dealing with severe economic banking crises, which is to cover it up. the Nikkei.
That was the zombie bank decade, right?
Well, it's now two decades, mm-hmm. right? The Nikkei remains at 25% of its peak value 19 years later. Let me say that another way. Imagine if the Dow Jones lost 75% of its value and stayed that way for two decades. What would America be like? Japan's in its fourth rolling recession, and it's a really severe recession, much more severe than ours currently. Spain has 17% unemployment. Iceland's collapsed. Ireland's largely collapsed. Latvia needs IMF bailout. Iceland needed an IMF bailout. You're right about Hungary and other nations are in a state of collapse, but no one wants to admit it because the Germans and others are playing the same games with their banks. Recognize losses? That would be a terrible thing. Do you know that Congress extorted the accounting profession to loosen the accounting rules so that banks could essentially give any value they wanted to their assets, and that they have done so? And surprise, those values are really, really high compared to the real value.
Well, at the moment, there's a political Band-Aid being offered. It's tied into the appropriations for the two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. A big chunk of change for the IMF that's supposed to put a Band-Aid over these vulnerable countries in the former Warsaw Pact and the Baltic states. That's being held up by the Republicans. Even Gates is now pleading with the Republicans not to be so stupid. What do you think will happen if that Band-Aid's not thrown their way? I mean, in other words, can an IMF Band-Aid, will that be sufficient to stop this thing from unraveling? And then we go through another. In other words, is this Europe subprime?
Yes, it will. I mean, Hungary will collapse, right? And the local currency has already collapsed, but it will further collapse. It'll produce a classic exchange rate crisis, just like it happened in Iceland. A number of these shoes are going to drop. Here in the United States, the pick-a-pay option arms, where you got to pick what rate you would pay, and virtually everyone picked a rate that in our jargon is deeply negative amortization. That means you're not even paying enough to pay the interest, which means the interest unpaid interest gets added to your principal. Can you imagine that? Those are going to cease that feature in the next two calendar years. And those are huge numbers. And they're really big here in California. Very popular product. Those people are going to suddenly face dramatically increased payments on houses that have lost very substantial value, where they're going to owe probably somewhere in the range often of 130% of the market value of their house. So, yes, there are many bad shoes to drop. The strategy will not work. It will make things far worse. The worst possible incentive is to leave the CEOs in charge of banks that they know are insolvent, where they produce the insolvency. Guess what strategy we followed? Exactly that strategy. And we know, both from economics and criminology and just plain human experience, that's the worst thing you can do. So naturally, it's the one we've done.
Well, but an economic collapse brings about the worst kind of politics. And we don't have an educated polity to begin with. Nobody's much as talking about what we're talking about here. The picture you're painting means that we're going to have a crisis and a collapse on our hands, and we'll have, you know, Newt Gingrich and Sarah Palin running the country.
Well, the savings and loan debacle led to a lot of very effective reforms. The Great Depression led to a number of very effective reforms, in part because, again,
We're not even talking reform. We're not talking prosecution. We're not talking reform.
I understand, but I'm not willing to give up. We are working with members of Congress, and we're trying to get change.